Okay, so one and two.
I am the principal investments advisor for the Manchester Guardian, said the Englishman, his reluctance evident in his low, hesitant voice. As scheduled, I've delivered the long-term economic projections relative to the paper's anticipated accelerating losses over the next decade. They call for supplemental capital far beyond anything envisioned by the Guardian's directors. There's no alternative but to seek a massive infusion of external funds or an affiliation with other journalistic publications. The man from The Guardian paused, adding quietly, I've had highly confidential meetings with my counterparts at The Independent, The Daily Express, The Irish Times, and The Edinburgh Evening News. He abruptly stopped. He was finished, his face set in disgust and defeat. Le Monde, Paris, Marseille, Lyon, there's no doubt of that, said a balding American in his middle 50s. The technological advances in computerized multi-feed print operations make it irresistible. One plant can service a minimum of six newspapers, tomorrow a dozen, with totally diversified copy. My contacts at the New York Times, the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and the Wall Street Journal are merely waiting for the first shoe to drop. They call it survival. You can add the Toronto Globe and Mail and the Edmonton Journal to the list, completed the fourth member of the row, a youngish Canadian, his eyes alive with the realization that he was among the elite of his profession. When I return, I'm heading west to initiate preliminary negotiations with the Winnipeg Free Press and the Vancouver Sun. Your enthusiasm is to be applauded, said the son of the shepherd boy, but keep in mind the walls of utter...
Two and three.
Open your hearts and your cupboards
absolutely
to your neighbor, and his
Janet
to you. Let all men high and low understand that we are one
said
family.
Just what
in
I
these times
wanted
of hardship and chaos
but
and high prices, what better way to overcome but to enter into the Spirit
into
of the Lord and truly show
dust
love for thy neighbor?
But his vision was
for a few days, let rancors subside and divisions be healed. Let the word go forth that all men are brothers, all women sisters, and altogether brothers and sisters, and very much each other's
weakness.
For but a few days, let charity and grace
concern
all the hearts of everyone, sharing the sweet and the sad, for there is no evil that can withstand the force of good. Embrace, raise the wine, show laughter and tears, and accept one another in expressions of love. Let the world see there is no shame in the exaltation of the Spirit. And once having touched, having heard the voices of brother and sister, carry forth the sweet memories beyond the feast of Saint Gennaro, and let life be guided by the principles of Christian benevolence. The earth can be a better place. It is up to the living to make it so. That was the lesson of Francesco the First.
A
computer at Dutch Intelligence picked up a glitch, which often signified a deletion in a past entry. The past in this instance was 24 years ago. A computer search was set in motion covering all government and court records, going back until that deletion was discovered. 24 years. It turned out to be the Amsterdam Civil Court Division of Titles and Nomenclature. A second physical search was mounted in the court's archives. The document unearthed and subjected to spectrographic x-rays. The glitch was found, the words restored. A 19-year-old law student at the University of Utrecht had his name legally changed, or more precisely, altered, his true last name eliminated. From that date forward, he was known as Jan Vandermeer, no longer Jan Vandermeer Matarazen. Matarazen, Dutch for Matariz. The final piece.
So you just stand up there. We do one and two.
He walked cautiously through the open door and closed it softly, turning the large brass key, then made his way down the corridor he had walked for weeks, toward the arc that led to the open area of the estate. From long nights of looking through the bars of his opposing windows, Jamie knew the grounds were patrolled by two guards with automatic rifles, strapped across their shoulders and sidearms holstered at their hips. Dressed in white Arabic robes and headdresses, they walked in casual, quasi-military fashion, meeting at the east and west walls and retracing their steps. The whitewashed arch that Montrose approached led to the east yard and wall, seen through the dim light shining from the main house. He crouched in the darkness of the stone corridor and waited until the two guards came into view, meeting at the center of the white wall. The guards paused, Mattingly lighting cigarettes and chatting. Jamie was suddenly alarmed. The blow he had dealt the guard, Khalil, was harsh enough to render him unconscious, but not life-threatening. There was no need for that. Khalil might well regain consciousness any minute, and there were a dozen ways he could make sufficient noise to attract the guards, kicking chairs, shoving plates off tables, smashing a television. So many ways. Young Montrose remained frozen, staring at the two Bahrainians, silently urging them to resume their patrol. Still they did not move, instead laughing quietly at some joke. Jamie Montrose began to sweat, perspiration born of anxiety and fear. It was common knowledge that the laws of the Arab Emirates were as tough as those anywhere in the world, depending upon whom one displeased, and that was the whom that determined the punishment. But what was he worried about?
So, you just come here in the middle?
Yeah.
You and Liam?
Or was it? That was the question, for Jamie could not adequately convince himself that he had been told the truth. There was simply too much that was too crazy. His mother would have reached him somehow, to let him know even a hint of what was going on. To think otherwise was nuts, as crazy as everything else that had happened. It came, a crash from his cell, followed by moans and muted screams at the window. Then the smashing of glass and china dishes. Finally, the collapsing of wood from a disintegrating table and desk. The two guards raced over to the east window, and Jamie held his breath, terrified that the worst would happen. It did not. They had no flashlights. The guards screamed in Arabic, each pointing in opposite directions, one to the north, the other to the arch where Jamie was crouched in the shadows. The second guard raced past him. Suddenly, searchlights were flashed on throughout the entire villa and its compound. There was no one yet on the east wall. It was his only chance. He ran out into the yard and raced to the 8-foot wall, jumping as he has never jumped before, ripping his bleeding fingernails as he gripped whatever crevices of stone he could feel. In sheer panic, he reached the top of the ledge. Then, again suddenly, he realized that his hands were drenched with blood. The wall was crowned not only with shattered glass, but also a coil of barbed wire, its points as sharp as razor blades. Jamie thought for a second, a millisecond. Circumstances, evaluate. What would Dad have done? The roving searchlights caught him in their beams and converged on his frozen figure. Thinking suspended, instinct his command, he leaped over the wall as a pole vaulter might, twisting his body in an arc and landing hard on his shoulders on the ground. His right arm was in agony, but he could live with it as long as he was out of his so civilized prison. Running wildly, he reached a dirt road. I'm excited, man.
That's it?
Yeah.